Blog Talk Radio.
I found this to be an interesting article. Everybody's been talking about the great Jubilee, you know, everyone's seen it on television and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, God save the Queen, but what about humanity? I think it's interesting to note that the Queen of England owns several trillion dollars worth of property, real estate, stocks, bonds, you know, you name it. She owns everything. You know, to be so enamored by her holiness, you know, or her majesty is quite a farce. But I think that this article kind of is interesting. It says, God save the Queen, ? On the thread below, an article about the great banking heist on a well-respected website appears in the following statement. Millions of good men and women throughout the world lost their jobs, their homes, their dignity as a result of the great banking heist. those who protested against it are arrested, and the people respond, the police response to protests is becoming increasingly militaristic, while those who caused the meltdown get off scot-free. The system is broken, and our response to this crisis will be a test of how intelligent we are as a species. I'm not holding my breath. Europe is in economic freefall, and meanwhile, the Jubilee celebrations go on day after day, and 80% of Britons are reported as supporting the monarchy. If people are this dim, cheering on the 1% for all they are worth, what hope is there for humanity? Let us reflect on well-articulated observation, for it says much about the extraordinary fickleness of our age. I was in England, this is from the Activist Post, by the way. I was in England during the main weekend of the Jubilee celebration and chose to watch maybe 1 hour on BBC television. The Queen, accompanied by Prince Charles and his wife Camilla, were traveling across central London in the Royals' Rolls to attend a banquet at the House of Parliament. Then afterward, at Buckingham Palace and a special appearance on the palace balcony. Well, the route was lined with flag-waving well-wishers from all walks of life and in many countries. Many wore paper hats and the Union Jack emblazoned on them and waved their similarly decorated little plastic flags. At Buckingham Palace, a vast crowd erupted into wild shrieks of joy as the Queen appeared on the royal balcony, and the yeomen of the guard stood to attention in full livery. Field guns delivered a perfectly coordinated royal salute, and jet aircraft streaked overhead in tight formation, leaving red, white, and blue trails behind them, red, white, and blue wherever the eye rested. And for much of the time, the 86-year-old Queen grimaced in response. She had, after all, done it so many times before during her 60-year reign of royal duty to the nation. The night before, she had worn a similar expression while attending a grand Jubilee concert in the palace precinct. However, at certain appointed moments, she managed to smile. And one such occasion was when a huge diamond-shaped contrivance was presented to her, while in the background, Sir Paul McCartney and Sir Elton John stood stiffly upright and expressionless. Paul's famous bass guitar emblazoned with the obligatory Union Jack. And once upon a time, John Lennon had returned his OBE, Order of the British Empire, as a protest against the British support for the Vietnam War. Well, Paul, however, had, after having kneeled before Her Majesty some years back to accept the place as a knight of the realm, could only play the obedient servant. No doubt other infamous Illuminati knights of the realm, such as Sir Henry Kissinger, Sir Alan Greenspan, raised a toast to Her Majesty across the waters, and even the thuggish Norman Schwarzkopf, knighted by the Queen for his brutal exploits in Iraq, may have raised a dull chuckle of recognition. Oh, and let's not forget Sir Edgar Hoover, the notorious chief former of the FBI. I mean, this is fascinating, isn't it? How many Americans have been dubbed Knights of the Crown? Okay, and yet, the obedient servant role appeared to be the choice of almost all those who attended this extravagant role of unfettered fetlock tugging British pageantry, accompanied by its open, near hysterical mass cheering. Beyond Buckingham Palace, thousands of special outdoor lunches, tea parties, and other such gatherings were taking place up and down the country, crowds enduring cold winds and even rains in their determination to show their very British support for the wealthiest woman in the world. Well, Elizabeth Windsor owns 1/6 of the landmass of our planet. 1/6, guys. A big estate. It consists of Canada, Australia, and the United Kingdom, plus many more smaller Commonwealth fiefdoms. Her crown estate does not attract inheritance or capital gains tax. She has 4 palaces in the UK, one of which Buckingham Palace occasionally opens its doors for special groups. And according to Lord Halsbury, law of the land, the sovereign can do no wrong and no laws can be brought against her. Clearly not. According to Heathcott Williams, her investment in BP, her investments in BP and Rio Tinto Zinc mean very simply that she profits from petrol and uranium, and her subjects get ill. She has never been heard to contradict the view that often crippling government wage and pension reducing austerity measures are exactly the right medicine for her subjects. None of this deters her adoring fans, and they variously describe her as a safe mother figure who somehow holds the country together while squabbling politicians do their worst. To everybody's auntie, a wonderful example of great upholding of tradition and such a lovely person. Well, such descriptions do not just come from fellow members of the British elite, but from millions of working people, once called working class, who apparently see in their queen some sort of salvation for the daily drudgery of their working lives. A vivid spectacle of what it means to get to the top, even if heights even can never be attained without belonging to that tiny core of intermarrying bloodline families who have nurtured their way to the very pinnacles of power and control. And that the British royal family still epitomizes some sort of fairy tale state of existence, untouched and untroubled by the hurly-burly of our racked and raped planet, is testimony to an extraordinary PR machine operating with military precision behind the scenes of the royal facade. Just the right amount of exposure and non-exposure, of fashion and tradition, of pomp and informality, of material, military prowess and social caring. It is an expertly managed and executed contrivance that instills in the people a hypnotic fascination, rendering the majority incapable of discernment or critique. This show blinds even sensible grown-up mortals who dreamingly proclaim British achievements in the colonies of yesteryear. For example, the way in which uneducated tribal peoples were taught manners and respect for those who corralled them into service or slavery, a situation now aped by the transnational corporate sweatshops that took over once the colonial train had departed. And it's still also a taboo in Britain not to see the British Empire as a munificent and proud era replete with dignity, morals, and high-minded ideals, of great military feats and remarkable civil engineering exploits. Never mind the shockingly brutal reality of tens of thousands slaughtered for daring to resist the conquering of their homelands, the wholesale re-education of those accustomed to cultural norms completely unrecognized by the colonizers, and the slaves, the economic exploitation, the intellectual property thieving, and installation of a foreign control system solely there to profit from an endless supply of cheap labor and abundant land and mineral wealth. History in the British schoolbook does not, I think, the young and vulnerable should hear such gruesome stories, or perhaps get a glimpse of a forerunner of today's military-industrial complex. Some commentators are saying that the British have now made psychological peace with the loss of colonies, humiliation of the contrasting virtual bankruptcy experienced by the country in the aftermath of the Second World War. But if so, how can one explain the ongoing reverence for the single greatest symbol of imperial ambition? Elizabeth Windsor, who has been happy to cement the special relationship with the USA, was lavishly praised by Barack Obama on the occasion of the Diamond Jubilee. She didn't fail to reiterate the value of this special relationship, which is, in practice, a deal between a republic and a monarchy to continue together the old colonial practice under another name, the War on Terror. The Brits getting the diplomacy and MI5 bit, and the U.S. getting the firepower factor and the kudos of Commander-in-Chief. A special relationship feared and loathed by much of the world, but not, it seems, by many of its paymasters, the taxpaying citizens of the British Isles and North America. Even as the young protégés, the dashing Prince William and the pretty Duchess's wife, smile and wave their youthful hands to an adoring world, the planet sinks ever further into conflict and confusion. And the wealth chasm between rich and poor grows even wider. The banking, agrochemical, pharmaceutical, and oil mafia grow even more arrogant, and the corporate power mongers continue to grow in on the establishment of a new world order. And maybe, just maybe, this reality is so unpalatable for the majority at the austerity receiving end, and apparently unscathed monarchy gliding miraculously above it all, presents the perfect escapist dream. A similar dream to the American dream, virtual bubbles for all those unable or unwilling to face the truth about themselves, the inhuman control systems which run the show, and our thoughtless complicity in the role in the whole mind-controlled misadventure. This article goes on a little bit more, but we have to go to our guest, and I want to do that right now. You know, it just amazes me, and it always has amazed me, how this idiotic monarchy it can control so much public attention. And, you know, it's just amazing. I'm just calling our guest right now. So, and our guest tonight, again, is Dennis Marker. And he is 15 Steps to Corporate Feudalism, How the Rich Convinced America. Hope you enjoy this.
This is Dennis Marker.
Hi, Dennis. How are you? It's L.A. Steel.
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Great, great. You know, I was just reading an article which makes me laugh. You know, I was bringing up your, introducing your book, but an article on the Queen of England and the Grand Jubilee, you know, and how this woman owns 1/6 of the entire planet, all right, under her name. It's unbelievable, isn't it? You know? I mean, she is the symbol for aristocracy and the elite, you know, around the world, and saluted by everybody. It's just one of the most sickest things I've ever seen. But you know, it goes on. So
well, it does. And the funny thing is, she's a holdover from the old feudal system. I mean, that wealth comes from that, and what we're talking about, what I'm talking about in the book, is how basically they're redoing it in a corporate model.
In a corporate model, yeah, sure. I enjoyed reading your book, and I thought it was quite interesting because, you talk from Reagan to the Tea Party, and, basically, people seem to forget how good the country was, even though we had a lot of revolution, a lot of problems during the 60s and the 70s, it wasn't until the Reaganomics and the Reagan era that we really got screwed over in the biggest ways, you know. And maybe I might explain that, because I've tried to explain for many years how Reagan was one of the was probably one of the worst presidents we've ever had, because he destroyed us. You know, he totally destroyed the middle class and government. So, right. Well, yeah, I know what your opinion is, but maybe you might want to explain it to the people and introduce your book.
Sure would. I would love to.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah. So, Ronald Reagan, I mean, Reagan clearly wasn't the mastermind, but Reaganomics, what was called Reaganomics at the time and also called the Reagan Revolution, was the beginning of destroying America's middle class. And what I do in the book is I use those, there's four charts that I put in there, and two of them I think are very telling. To this day, you have Tea Party people who actually talk about Reagan being the great president. And it's one of the great cons of our time.
Well, Bush and Romney, both Romney now. I mean, Romney thinks he's the reincarnation of Reagan, you know. And, of course, Bush won his presidency by mimicking Reagan, you know.
Well, sure, carrying on the same policies. Or as I say in the book, Bush two actually implemented the policies that Reagan originally announced, but were so radical at the time that it took 30 years for Bush to implement them.
Oh yeah, no, it's true. And you know, I have to admit, I hate to admit it, but back in the 80s, I voted for Reagan, you know, and that was probably the worst thing I ever did. Because I had never voted for a Republican at that point, but I, you know, the whole nightmare with Carter and the Democratic Congress at that point was just frightening. I mean, the scandal and the corruption within the parties at that point, made Reagan seem. I don't know, a savior, you know, for the American people.
Right, but I would say that a lot of that had to do with how the conservatives learned to repackage their message. So the idea of Reagan being, you know, this great helper to the middle class, it had nothing to do with reality, as the 15 steps in my book talk about. And more importantly, the charts that I mentioned, you look at the charts going way back, you know, and look at deficit spending. And so you look at the chart, the first chart I have in my book, all of a sudden you get to Reagan and the deficit spending starts. So
that's
on
right.
One hand, they're saying to people, we're going to cut taxes on the rich and balance the budget and increase the military. That was the message. So it was a something for nothing message.
Right.
The reality, when you look at the numbers, is, oh my gosh, look, what Reagan figured out was that he could just start running up this deficit to make it look like we were prosperous by spending the nation into debt.
True.
So, brilliant messaging.
Not only that, just might I add that what he did, I mean, he got us out of a massive recession, but he did it by opening up the banks, you know. And, you know, by massive, massive debt. And we've never been that. We've never seen that kind of debt until, of course, now, after Bush. But, you know.
But it started with Reagan.
I'm sorry. Reagan in the 80s were responsible for the massive, inflation that we saw, the insanity of, the housing prices and the military spending and Star Wars and every other god-awful, insane delusional concept that has got us into trouble today. You were right, you know, in your book and in the graphs that you showed. But how did we fall for this? How did we all fall for this mass delusion, you know, under Reagan, you know?
Well, that's what my book is. When I talk about the 15 steps to corporate feudalism, how the rich convinced America's middle class to eliminate themselves. And I think, for me, that's the brilliance of what they did. So if 30 or 35 years ago, a few people, the what we now call the 1%, but the very wealthy came along and said, you know, we no longer need a middle class in the United States. We feel it's redundant, so we're going to get rid of you and move into a more feudal system. The people would have revolted and rebelled. And so the question is, if you decide economically that you don't need a middle class, the question is, how do you convince the middle class to accept what you're doing? I mentioned the classic story, excuse me, Leo, the classic story of the frog in the water. They say if you try to throw a frog in boiling water, it'll jump right out. But if you just heat the water slowly, the frog won't notice. I believe that's what happened to us. So I lay out the specific steps in the book, and the way I approach it is I sort of present each step with the question, if you wanted, for the whole book, if you wanted to eliminate the middle class, how would you do it? The middle class of 30 years ago, which was a very powerful and strong middle class, not now, not today's middle class. And then I go through each step and say the same thing. Okay, if you know you need to control the media in order to get the middle class to accept eliminating themselves, how do you get control of the media? And so that really is the way that I approach the book, and I think that's, as I say, the brilliance of what they've done.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah, you were absolutely right on that as well.
How do we repair the damage? This is Lila speaking. How do we repair the damage that's been done?
Well, the first thing is, I say in the book, and I just happen to believe it's true, the first thing to do to fix the problem is understand how you got there. You understand
mm-hmm.
we have a problem. And so I say, and I believe completely this is true, we have to accept that what I call the corporate feudalists, we can name them whatever we want. I think that's a term people can understand. Feudalism
mm-hmm.
in corporations, they get it. But the first thing is we have to understand they won this round. And so
yeah.
And once we accept that they won this round, then we have to accept that we can't make simple incremental change that will fix the problem. This problem has actually dramatically occurred over the course of 30 years. And so right now, because they've won, one of the things that means is that our democracy, or what was a democracy, is now basically a wealthocracy or whatever. What happens is that the people at the top spend the money that's necessary to buy the politicians they want to get the laws passed that they want. And
mm-hmm.
and we're not going to simply be able to change that by some incremental change, by going to Congress, for an example, and saying, you know what, money in politics has gotten out of hand. We need to go to a public financing system, or we need to do some other system. Because the people who are there now represent the interests that are winning. And
right.
so that's first. Then I actually lay out some specific things that we do. And I would say, as I look at how the wealthy, the very wealthy, the corporate feudalists convince the middle class to eliminate themselves, I say, there was a plan here. It seemed radical when they introduced it. And,
mm-hmm.
and of course, they said it was going to do the opposite of what it did. So what I call for is actually people who want to return to a middle-class democracy in the United States need to have a plan that's as comprehensive and radical and states what we actually want as opposed to an incremental change. An example I use is right now we could say, well, you know, having a capital gains tax on billionaires that's lower than, what is it, the Buffett rule, where it's lower than what a secretary pays is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But we could say, well, let's move it from 15% to 17 or 18%. Well, that's not going to get it done. What we need to do instead of fighting over the crumbs is say, in order to return America, United States, to a strong, vibrant middle class, this is what we're going to have to do, which means completely reversing the trade policies and going back. In fact, I had a conversation yesterday with the chief of staff. It was on the radio for a Republican congressman. And I said, one of the things we don't do well in the United States is learn from our own past or from what other countries do successfully. So
mm-hmm.
we had a vibrant middle class 30 years ago, 35 years ago. And so one of the things that we could do is go back and say, what were the things we did then up until Reaganomics that were so successful for the middle class? Another thing we could do is go ahead.
Oh, we had a Congress that formulated laws that were supportive to the middle class.
Well,
precisely.
Yeah.
And I would say that we had a goal. I believe that the goal of our legislature, our politicians at that time, was to preserve a middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had goals that were that way, and we had trade policies to support that.
Yep.
But what have we done now? I mean, one of the craziest things that we do, the list is massive, but one thing we do is we allow a foreign country to ship goods they make, whether it's from a U.S. manufacturer or not, doesn't matter, but they make a good in a foreign country, Honduras, pick Honduras, they can ship it up here duty-free. Now, say we want to send our products made here, down there, they charge a duty. So, I mean, up until Reaganomics, up until when they announced this idea of getting rid of all of our tariffs and supposedly global free trade, that wasn't the case. You know, when they started saying we want to have global free trade, protectionism became a bad word. But if you look at the successful economies in the world, the middle class ones, they do exactly that. They work to protect their middle class because they don't think it's a bad thing. They think it's a good thing.
That's right.
And
another,
I'm sorry.
No, please.
Yeah. No, to me, because I'm in the media, because we've been fighting this for so long, you know, what happened in the Office of the Public Diplomacy under Reagan, you know, was just, and of course, at the time when this all happened, I wasn't in this business. I was actually in real estate, and I was, profiting in the 80s. And but what happened under this Office of Public Diplomacy, and you mentioned it, Major, I love the way that you mentioned it in the book, is they totally took over the media. They totally intimidated, they threatened NPR to stop funding them. They threatened any left center or even moderate news reporting, and created the conservative right wing insanity machine, and this to me was probably the key to brainwashing the media. For up until today,
brainwashing the citizenry, media.
Not the media, man. The citizens, the United States. Would that? Can you go into that just a little to explain to the people how overt the pressure was, by Reagan's administration,
sure,
and establishing this Office of Public Diplomacy.
Right. So I say in the book that in order to control a population, you have to control the information. That's one thing that's essential. And in a dictatorship, you simply, the dictator owns the media, and if you disagree, they kill you or throw you in jail. So in the United States, of course, of 30 years ago, you didn't have to do, you couldn't do that. You know, the government didn't own the media, so how do you get the media to report the way you want to? And starting with the Reagan administration, who was known for being, the best at controlling the media, they started doing a lot of different things. Office of Public Diplomacy was one of them. And in that case, they monitored the media. And if the media came out with a story that was negative, considered negative to the Reagan administration's position, they got a phone call from the Office of Public Diplomacy. They would get visits. I mentioned the case at NPR, which is really fascinating, because I had a meeting with three of the top NPR people many, many years ago. I was working in that business, and they told me a story about getting a call from the head of OPD, and his name was Otto Wright, and he was going to come down, and he wanted a meeting because they had this story on El Salvador and this massacre in El Salvador, and it was very damaging to the goals of the Reagan administration. So the NPR officials figured that the reporter got the story wrong, and they were going to get, basically chewed out for making this bad report. Well, when he gets there, the head of OPD, he doesn't have anything to say about the accuracy of the report at all. In fact, that was not the question. Basically, he said, this hurts our administration's policy, which therefore means our government's policy, and we need you to not report things like this. And the threat was, if you continue to do reports like this, then we're going to have to look at NPR funding. This was the beginning of the long trend toward conservatives saying, let's get rid of NPR, let's cut their funding. But nonetheless, the point was that if you reported something that was not to the administration's liking, you got the call and the threat, and it had nothing to do with whether the story was accurate, which is the bigger point, I think, in this whole thing with regard to the media. There were a whole lot of other things we talk about, deregulation, just starting the charge of liberal bias of the media, getting rid of the fairness doctrine. They're all things that worked to get control over the media. But what we ended up with was a situation now where the way the media, this is the mainstream media, obviously you have shows like yours, and there's all sorts of things like that that aren't having to answer to this, but we have what I call the balance standard. And the balance standard is, I can say anything. Say I'm running for president. I can say anything. And instead of the reporters actually reporting on whether it's true or not, they'll simply report what the other side said. And that's a huge difference from 35 years ago, when the job of the U.S. media, they actually saw their job as trying to find out what was true and reporting it. And now it's just, okay, you know, it's the old, you know, you beat your wife. Oh, you know, yes, I do. No, I don't. But there's no one looking into saying what's true. And why that's important is because, as Thomas Jefferson said in many, many different ways, you cannot have a democracy without an informed public. And
that's
so if you can get, so if you can get the public to not believe their media, even when it's telling the truth, and get the media to not actually try to find the truth but simply report what someone says, then what do you end up with? A non-informed public. When you have a non-informed public, obviously, you can manipulate them into doing anything you want.
Well, I found this that to be the case for the last 10 years, at least 20, maybe even 20, right back to 87. But you know, when I stopped believing the media, you know, it's worse than ever. It's nothing more than infotainment. You know, hours of nothing.
Our our local stations, the biggest thing that they have, say, on TV is they report all the fires in the state,
yeah,
all the car accidents, the murders, and the weather.
And the weather is
a big deal if it's going to rain or it's going to do something.
Yeah, and a couple of gaffes of by the state legislature or something.
But
it's like the most useless, absolutely useless, broadcast that I've ever seen, and it's just getting worse and worse.
And I'm sure it's that way around the country. They never really comment on what's happening in our state legislature, what bills have been brought up, where they're going with the bills,
any positions
on one side or the other.
Sure.
They bring up very little.
You have to go to C-SPAN to see anything. And then on top of that, what I find to be the most egregious thing that they do, all right, is that they not only do they not report, but they report wrongly, okay? And, you know, and they bring out these high-priced bimbos and airheaded talking heads, okay? Talk about nothing. Interview some celebrity, interview some jackass politician who's on his way out the door. You know, everybody buys for bows at Obama's feet to interview him, you know, and there's never anything, not one thing that's ever that has any objectivity or substance to it. You know, it's nothing more than pablum. You know?
I'm sure you find that
I just read an article on the air the other night about CNN. Losing half its audience, and MSNBC losing its half of its audience over the last 18 months. Nobody wants to watch these clowns. And as far as the mainstream networks, you know, they only get like 25% or so of the overall audience. Nobody respects this group anymore. However, they are still essentially the mouthpieces of our nation. You know, how do we fight this any further? I mean, how can we fight this?
Well, that's the beauty of it. That's why I say I really think we're to the point where we have to just make a comprehensive plan, because trying to fight them, I mean, they own the media. Right now, you know, one of the things we say, America has a free press. That's true, but it happens to be owned by the highest bidder. And until we change that, I can give you an example, a really funny example. I did a press conference in Costa Rica years and years ago, and over the wars in Central America, whatever. So I did this press conference. I came back to the U.S., and I read what I said, and I thought, man, I'm an idiot, because what I meant to say was completely different, which was in all the U.S. papers. Well, back then, I used to get a clipping service, and so the Canadian papers came a few days later. Well, the Canadian papers got me exactly right, what I thought I said and what, in fact, I had said. The Canadians covered. Then a few weeks later, the Australian papers show up, and the and the Austrian papers and the German papers, and guess what? Everyone in the world could understand what I was saying at that press conference except the U.S. reporters. So I realized right then that the problem wasn't me. The problem was what I was saying was not acceptable in the United States. It was not part of the government line, and the government had the ability to exercise enough control over our supposedly free media that they could keep me from actually saying what I said. And
well, we know the media doesn't even have an overseas news service.
Yeah, exactly. But, William Colby, the CIA director, was quoted as saying that we own everybody in the media.
Yep.
We own the media, all right? Nobody says anything that we don't approve, okay? And that was those are his exact words. So if that's the case, and that was back in the 80s, all right? You know what it's like now. I mean, it's completely dominated. Dominated in the 80s. It's dominated even more so today. And we get absolutely no foreign news whatsoever of any value in this country, other than the support of our killing Syrians or Libyans or Afghanis or, you know, Iraqis or whoever we're at war at. Go, gung ho. And you
mentioned
this
in
your book.
Anybody that gets in the way of our expansionist policy.
And you mentioned this in a chapter in your book. Which I agreed with totally, and that's making people understand support these insane wars. You know.
Sure. Sure,
yeah.
And that's, you know, in terms of the 15 steps, I mean, you can go through them. I mean, I start with the media and then creating your own propaganda network. But if your goal is to, as I say, destroy, eliminate the middle class and just create this corporate feudal republic where the former middle class are fighting over crumbs at Walmart with no health insurance and, you know, not enough to actually support the middle class lifestyle, if your goal is to eliminate the middle class, everything is going great. And so...
Yeah.
And so creating unnecessary wars has a lot of benefits. One thing, it keeps people focused on something other than their day-to-day existence and what's happening, you know, as I said, to the U.S. middle class. Another thing, of course, go ahead.
What that does, you don't want those rebels here. That's what the British always had, perpetual wars, too, for that reason. They didn't want to ever bring their armies home. That's what made Rome fall.
No,
exactly.
What do you got? Three or four, I don't know what the number is today, it was under Reagan, we went up to 3 million homeless, and then I believe it's probably 10 or 20 million homeless today in this country, but there, of course, it's not being reported. But in your chapter 3 of the book, you said that destroying of the unions was one of the major...
goals. Yeah, I believe that.
And by destroying the unions, you destroyed the middle class. And, of course, we're now, I mean, back in the 70s, I think we were 30, this country had over 30% of the workforce was unionized. Today, it's only 12%, and being reduced faster and faster. And, how do you convince these morons to unionize? I mean, I just get so flabbergasted, so frustrated with people.
Well, the propaganda,
I understand that, Lila.
Against unions on the media.
I understand
that's
that, Lila.
Part
but
of the problem
is that people don't. It's like you said. How the rich convince America to eliminate themselves, and this is exactly what's going on. Eliminate all the good jobs in the country, all the good middle class jobs in the country. And then you got people fighting against one another, saying, "Oh, you're making too much money."
Well, that's the old-fashioned rule: divide and conquer.
Yeah.
And the media does that very well. They pit ordinary middle-class people against people who are in unions, saying that they're sucking off you, they're taking advantage of you.
They're the taxpayer.
That's right.
That's
a very old formula that always works well.
Yeah, and you know. You were right on that chapter, by the way, I wanted to say. And But it's nevertheless still frustrates me to no end to see how people, how the middle class just doesn't get it. You know, they don't get it. You know, and how do you make them get it, Dennis? How do we make them get it?
Do you think Occupy Wall Street got it?
That's right. Well, Occupy Wall Street definitely got it. But one of the things I did, one of the reasons I wrote this book and wrote it the way that I did, is I think it's the kind of book. I was talking to someone from Kansas the other day on a radio show, and he said, you know, my mother, who's a Republican, can understand this. And so one of the things people have to do is understand what happened. You take the unions. One of the things, you know, now we have this thing like Wisconsin, you know, it's all unions are bad. Yeah. Well, try to find a country anywhere in the world with a vibrant middle class that doesn't have a vibrant union movement. Doesn't exist.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So if you can get the middle class to say, well, wait a minute now. If there are no countries in the world that don't, you know, that are middle class that don't have a strong union movement and we're getting rid of our unions, what is going to happen to us? So you ask, what can you do? I think, you know, my feeling is, and I've been told this by, you know, professors and everything else, people read this book, this simple little book, and it helps people, like, takes a prism. You look, read this book, and all of a sudden policies that make absolutely no sense make complete sense. Because you turn things on your, you know, the idea with this book is to turn things on their head. So you look at it and say, oh, well, it doesn't make sense to give tax cuts to the rich if you actually want, and given our economy right now especially, if you want to promote the middle class. But if you want to eliminate the middle class, it makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
Same with getting rid of the unions. It makes
right.
no sense if you want to preserve a strong middle class. But, boy, if you want to get rid of the middle class, they've got to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said another one I mentioned here. Well, global free trade. The idea, on the face of it, the idea that an American middle class worker can compete fairly with a person who maybe is almost a slave in some foreign country making $3 a day and say, well, we don't need any tariffs, or, you know, surely the U.S. middle-class worker can compete with the worker from Honduras. I'm not picking on Honduras, but many, many countries. It's ridiculous. How does that work? I mean, if I'm the factory owner and all I care about is myself and my profit, and someone says, well, you can go hire a worker for $3 a day or hire someone in the United States for a middle-class wage and on my moral and don't care about anything other than myself, well, gee, I'll take the guy for $3 an hour. I mean,
yeah, and my answer to that is why do you promote slavery around the world?
Precisely, and that's what I was going to say.
He says that to him.
Yeah, and I love the fact, well, I love it, yeah, the hypocrisy of it, the great Bill Clinton, the great son of a bitch, okay, that approved
Democrats
that pushed NAFTA,
held out all the
you know, and created this nightmare, all right, and then it was perpetrated till now under the great abomination, all right, is like, what are we dealing with here? I mean, it's just overwhelming crap that we're seeing that we just cannot get rid of, and now what do you got? You got Romney, and you got Obama running, okay? You got nothing. You got two peas in an empty pod. You know, it's just like nothing. What do the people have to look forward to? What can they vote for? What kind of
neither of them.
There's nothing there. All right.
Well,
that's
where we've gotten to. I lay this out, so I say it started with Reaganomics. It clearly started with the conservatives. And remember, when Clinton was elected, the truth is he was a conservative Democrat. They brilliantly named him a liberal, but he never was. He was a big-time conservative, and when he supported NAFTA, the hardcore liberals all opposed him, but the moderates and the conservatives all loved it. And it was, you know, and I mentioned in the book, I mean, clearly one of the great steps toward moving us closer to corporate feudalism was NAFTA. Russ Perot got it right. And
well,
Russ
Perot in 92 and was overwhelmed by what happened to him. And
well, they couldn't allow him to be elected. They couldn't allow that.
Yeah.
That's right. And I'd say that they have enough control now, you know, to the corporate feudalists, in my view, it really doesn't matter. They can tolerate, you know, Romney or Obama. You know, they're they're fine with him. But boy, try to put someone in there who's not going to toe that line. Like a couple of years ago, when someone like Dennis Kucinich ran, no matter what, he's never going to raise the money, get the credibility to be allowed to run.
With Ron Paul.
Ron Paul. It's exactly my point. Ron Paul doesn't matter. They're never. And if this, unfortunately, the way our electoral system is right now, it's based on whoever raises the most money wins. And
mm-hmm.
even if Ron Paul had more money, the media would find a way to trash him. So he's just not going to be acceptable to the corporate feudalists, so it's not happening. And so that's where we get to the last chapter of my book, which talks about answers. And an obvious answer, we all know it's true, is that we have to get money out of politics because that controls the system. Same with the media. We have to get our media ownership away from being controlled by whoever has the most money. We cannot expect to be told the truth. And so, you look at BBC or Canadian Broadcasting in Canada or Australian Broadcasting, where they have very severe rules, strict rules about reporting, and part of it has to do with accuracy. It's not simply.
I have to disagree with you there because
There's
nothing more bull than BBC, especially BBC America. It's a crock of crap what comes across them. If you watch the BBC in this country. They just say crap with an English accent. And, they maybe give you a little more international news, but it's all the same crap. They only give you one side of it, I don't agree. To me, the BBC is, British bullshit channel, what I mean? Yeah, as well as NPR. Greg Pulaski used to call it the National Petroleum Radio. They're totally corporately owned, and they have no balance.
And they are also buying up every airway that they can get.
We got knocked off our very popular FM show because they took
over our airwaves.
Consortium, we now have three NPR stations in a very small area in Connecticut, and I'll tell you why. Because we were the most vocal and most outspoken program in the tri-state area, which included New York, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. And man, I mean, the heat that came on our station, independent station owners, was amazing. However, they still stood fast with our programming, and still, what happened was they came in with an unbelievably generous
sweet offer
to the owner to buy them out.
To
lease it out. And the owner was getting on in age, and he said,
you couldn't turn it down.
Yeah, I can't turn this deal down, many thousands of dollars a month. An income, and he says it's still kind of a liberal format, I said, Dennis, I'll tell you the truth, I understand your situation. I can't buy the station for $2 million, and nobody else can either except Clear Channel. So I said, I guess you got your.
We have three NPR stations in this area. That's all we get.
So,
for radio.
But fortunately, what we did is while we were doing that, we've been on this internet program for over 8 years now, and plugging hard and gaining a good audience. But the problem is that when we started, this is an interesting fact. When we started in 2003 on commercial radio, there was only the Democratic Party did a poll or a study on radio stations and showed that there were only 80 hours a week of liberal talk show programming against 3,000 hours of conservative talk show programming.
I'm sure it's worse than that now.
All right, that was back in 2003. right? So you can imagine what it is now. It's probably 900,000 hours, you know what I mean, of conservative talk show against 9 hours of liberal talk
show. They couldn't even, the radio station that Rachel Maddow was on.
Oh, yeah, Air America.
Air America.
You know, died a horrible death.
Died a death. They couldn't, they couldn't even continue.
Yeah, so, you know, the death of the the free speech is really horrible, and is what happened to everybody.
The only time you get political balance is that 60 days before an election. Supposedly, that law is on the books.
Well, except that now you can spend, and a corporation even can spend as much as they want to. So you might get. You might get balance or supposed, you know, some sort of parity with what the actual campaigns do, but then whoever has the most, you know, gazillions of dollars behind them in this private money is still going to be on, you know. I used to do political work, and back 45 years ago, even a long time ago, we used to basically have a formula, which is if you were the incumbent and you spent a dollar more than a challenger, you could get in. If you were the challenger and you spent twice as much as the incumbent, you could get in. So it was still based on politics, but totally different. Now, I mean, they're coming in and spending 8, 10, 20 times more. And all that money does is, well, all it, one of the things it can do is just constantly give a dishonest message to people who are too busy, too stressed out to know any more than what they hear. And so if Scott Walker wants to say over and over again that he's created more jobs than any other state, even though it's the opposite, if people hear that message over and over again,
they believe it.
And that's what happens. And I want to go back. I wasn't defending NPR. I mean, NPR, I think 30 years ago, really was something. But they've, you know, I agree with Greg Palast, they've gotten so controlled. The point I was making about the places like Australian broadcasting or Canadian broadcasting is they have some standards. And basically, if you report things consistently that are false, at least within those countries, there's a board that comes and says, you know what, we have a problem here. And I think that we need something like that in this country. There should be some kind of independent commission that at least looks at media, and if it's constantly false and misleading, and provably so, there ought to be something that we do, at least to say you can't call yourself news. I don't think there's any way you should be able to shut. Say for me, Fox is not news. I don't call it news. It's just propaganda. It's Republican propaganda, conservative propaganda. It's been that way since the beginning.
So is CNN, MSNBC.
So they,
I
don't have trouble.
NBC and CBS. They're all propaganda machines. There is not one of them that's a legitimate news agency anymore. You know, they write and create their own news. You know, it's like God.
Sad. But let's
the difference. The difference. I'll just make this one point from my perspective. The difference between Fox and the others. I mean, I don't believe any of it. First off, you know, say take Occupy or take the Tea Party. You know, before that, the news. I don't believe any of it, but I think with the other networks, the only thing that's consistent is that it's going to be consistently pro-corporate. But you know, maybe they're going to cover it. Maybe it'll be a little more right. Maybe it'll be a little more left, depending on the reporter, depending on the story, whatever. With Fox, since
big
the day
pharma,
it was born.
Big food.
Well, that's right. All the pro-corporate. It's going to, you're going to cover those favorably.
The difference between the two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. I always felt that the Democrats threw a few more peanuts to the middle class than the Republicans. That's the only difference. Now they're just throwing the shells because they don't even have to throw the peanuts anymore.
Well, right, and now, even if any of us, if the three of us wanted to run for Congress right now, the only way that we could win would be to go raise millions of dollars. I forgot, you know, I don't know exactly. I always know each time, each election, it's what the average member had to raise to win. But you're not going to get that from $5 and $10 contributions. And so the only way any of us, regardless of how progressive we are or what our position is, the only way we're going to win is if we raise millions and millions of dollars. And the only way we're going to raise those millions of dollars is if we appeal to the corporations that can write those million-dollar checks.
Here's a fascinating Yeah, here's a fascinating example of that not being true. In that there's a woman named Linda McMahon who's running in Connecticut for a Senate, and she ran against Richard Blumenthal back in 2010.
I know the race.
You know the race, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she was the chairman of the, she was the president and the head of the World Wrestling Federation. And she spent $50 million of her own bell last year, 2 years ago, right? Everybody in Connecticut was getting a dear a letter from Linda, you know, in their mail twice or three times a week, and on TV and everything. Well, she lost. Even though she had a very strong race and she put a lot of dough behind it, and she's running again now, for Lieberman's seat, and she probably will lose, all right. But the fact that I was very surprised that she lost to Blumenthal after that scandal of his lying about being a Vietnam veteran, you know. But there, and again, I don't know. The political world just doesn't seem to make any sense. She outspent Blumenthal by 2-1, all right? But she lost. So
right.
And there weren't that many people that were overly loved to Blumenthal, all right, either. In this state, but
there's always an exception to every rule. Let's face it.
Well, so, right, and I wasn't suggesting the reverse. It's true that she would not have had a chance if she hadn't had that $50 million to spend. You can spend $50 million and still lose, but you cannot win without spending the $50 million. The $50 million or $100 million, right? But the point is it's based on money. Yes, Blumenthal, and it's the same Jerry Brown one in California when he was outspent by a great amount. But both of those races had free national media. They were big stories. She was a big story because of the Wrestling Federation thing. So there was a lot of free media, both pro and con, you know. And so everybody heard about those candidates over and over again, even if you lived out here in the West.
Right.
And same with Jerry Brown, you know, he might have gotten outspent, but he had enough money, millions, and he had the free media as well.
And name recognition from a long time.
And that's worth a fortune. Point is that we could not run if they gave me $1 billion and said, Dennis Marker, we want you to be the next president. I might be able to make it. If I got to outspend whoever I was running by enough, I just might get in. But it's guaranteed that I wouldn't have a chance if I didn't have huge amounts.
Into the primary. But a billion, yeah.
Well, we've come right to the end of our show.
There's one more thing I wanted to ask you before we go.
Okay.
I wanted to say that, buying the presidential election now, is happening. And, each candidate this year is going to be spending over $1 billion, raising over $1 billion. What is your take? Who do you see as the better candidate, in your opinion, and how do you, what would you advise our listeners to research or look at? And what kind of hope do we have?
Well, as I mentioned in the last chapter of the book, our hope is basically when we get together and say we're not going to accept, we're not going to take this anymore. We want our middle class, and these are the things we do to preserve it. So that's the hope we have. There's no hope in the traditional political system. My own sense is that where I stand, the number one issue that still makes a difference. There's some issues that don't make any difference. There's no separation between, the president and Mitt Romney. Other places, there's slight separation. One place that I think is extremely important is the Supreme Court. And so, for me, the decisions that the Supreme Court made that I have the most problem with, including the Citizens United, which just said corporations are people and money is speech, That was the conservatives. And so for that reason alone, I am going to, you know, end up voting for President Obama, because I do not want another conservative who is completely controlled by corporations. The way I look at the Supreme Court, you have the corporate side, what I call the extreme court, the five members that are there now, and then you have four moderates at best. But I would rather have another moderate on the court than another complete corporatist. But the best I can hope for short term is a slowing of the move to complete corporate feudalism. I mean, I think Occupy was an incredible thing in terms of waking people up to the idea that a few people are controlling more and more of the country. And so if we go slowly toward corporate feudalism, maybe we can create more citizen movements like that that actually can make a difference. But it's grim. The choices aren't great, and I agree with you.
Yeah, I don't know. This is the first presidential election I've thought of not voting, and because I just consciously can't make that choice in good conscience. You got a militarist, Obama, and a corporatist who's also a corporatist, and you got a corporatist Romney. I mean, the choices are horrible. You know?
That's the way I filled. Out a survey for some organization today, and they said describe the president. You know, president. And I said corporatist, and they said Mitt Romney, and I said I had another adjective to go with corporatist. But it's unfortunate that that's what we've come to. But my own feeling is that I don't want to stop participating in the system. I want to slow down this march until we can actually turn it around. Hopefully, you know, my book is a drop in the bucket of trying to turn around, you know, to move us away from corporate feudalism, to see what's happening and to say, no, we're not going there.
Well, we need many voices that speak like you, and we appreciate your message. And how can people get your book?
Best way is just go to the15steps.com.
Okay.
And that's my website. I've got a little blog and just, you know, getting that up, putting a few little funny little movies on there, some little puppet shows and things. Anyway, having a little fun. Got to have fun. Got to keep laughing in spite of what's happening to us. My feeling.
Well, we hope you sell
anyway.
And we encourage our listeners to support you.
Are you also on Amazon or any of the majors? Or
it is on Amazon, but if people go to my website, it's the same price, and I send it off free shipping as well. But then you can, you know, as I say, see the blog and see some of the other stuff, and so it works out better for me to go to the 15 steps. And
right.
for the person buying it, it's exactly the same.
So it's 15 steps. Is that the name of the website?
The website, The 15 Steps.
The 15 steps. Okay.
Just Google Dennis Marker. It pops up that way.
All right.
I'm easy to find. Hey, thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.
I really did too, and I wish you a lot of success in this, and I hope to maybe we can have you on again in the near future and find out how you're doing.
I'd love to. I'd love to.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. And that was. That was Dennis Marker, and his book is called 15 Steps to Corporate Feudalism, and I believe you can get it from his website, which is 15 Steps.
Mm-hmm.
And we ending the show tonight, and we thank you very much for listening, and join me here again tomorrow night.